This is Book Club Cheats, a podcast for book clubbers who just can't seem to find the time to read. I'm your host, Lippy Turner Roman, and today we'll be talking about Real Life by Brandon Taylor. Brandon Taylor's Real Life tackles the weekend of a black, queer, passive, introverted male PhD candidate named Wallace. Starting on a Friday evening, the book covers Wallace's interactions, big and small, with his friends at an unnamed Midwestern, predominantly white university. Real Life juxtaposes academia and graduate work with a seemingly real life outside of the rarefied ivy towers. The book explores microaggression, diphasia, overt and banal racism, and recollections of childhood trauma and complex notions of sexuality. Real Life is a semi-autobiographical tale, since Taylor, like Wallace, is a queer black man who left a science program at a Midwestern university. Taylor has a phenomenal ability to use words to create a lush world of alienation and loneliness while allowing the reader a snippet inside the tumultuous mind of Wallace. The book asks how much of our real life, our inner life, our worries and desires do our friends and acquaintances want or need to know, and can they handle our real life world and real lives? The group of people in the book think of themselves as friends, but they really behave as frenemies. Besides being graduate students in the same program and working and living in the labs in the same building, I had a hard time finding commonalities and reciprocal kindness in this group. This group isn't together because they like each other. There is no liking. This group appears to be held together by their shared life in the lab, their white privileged background and ideals of academic utopia. They bond on departmental gossip about the lives, careers and fates of the individual faculty members. The individuals that is alienated and not a fully integrated member of the group is Wallace. His so-called friends, while speaking and offering Wallace counsel and silent support, never speak up for him publicly to the group. In fact, when Wallace is faced with racism, unpleasantness, his friends ignore it and stay silent. In fact, this group of so-called friends have a lot of awkward silences. Wallace meets his friends for a Friday evening drink at the lake. After his plate of nematodes, his work for the past 3 months gets contaminated with mold. We later find out it's a work of sabotage by Donna, another graduate student in his lab. Wallace copes by putting it on the back burner. He receives the open invite for drinks in his inbox every week, which Wallace declines every week. His friends are surprised to see him. The group meets and socializes at each other's places and homes, but Wallace infrequently joins them. Over the course of the weekend, the group meets at Miller and Yagni's place on Saturday night and has brunch on Sunday morning. Wallace's frenemies group consists of Cole and his boyfriend, Vincent. Vincent is not a student and works at a real job, and he has a real sharp tongue. He chafes at the time Cole puts in at the lab. Lucas and his boyfriend, Nate, Emma and her boyfriend, Tom, Roman and Klaus, international students who are in an open relationship. Yang Vi, a straight guy, seemingly in a relationship with Enid. Yang Vi and Lucas are deeply in love, but can't move forward due to Yang Vi's inability to acknowledge his sexual fluidity. And Miller, a straight guy filled with repressed anger and who Wallace has a crush on. Emma gets it out of Wallace that his father died some weeks ago and he didn't go to the funeral. Wallace tells us his father did nothing for him. There's a lot of anger, sadness, loss and confusion in Wallace. While expressing sympathy, it's apparent that the group wonders why Wallace didn't go to his father's funeral. Wallace and Miller have an encounter in the men's room and go back to Wallace's apartment where they have sex. In fact, this book has some graphic descriptions of sex and violations. Overt and banal racism pepper both real life and Wallace's life. Wallace is made to feel intellectually inferior. It's implied he probably only got accepted to get diversity points for the university, not for his academic qualifications. Simone, Wallace's advisor, is liberal, condescending, and patronizing as hell. Simone has an all-female lab, except for Wallace. Wallace spends all of his waking and some of his non-waking hours working in the lab. His five lab mates are Katie, who's desperate to graduate, and also who is very dismissive of Wallace, but finds that she needs his results to graduate. Faye and Su Yin, who are either nocturnal or hidden away, encased by chemicals and experiments, so are out of sight, out of mind. Brigitte, a Chinese-American from Palo Alto, who is Wallace's only friend in the lab, and Dana, Wallace's nemesis, who is clumsy, sloppy, a mediocre student, and Simone's pet. When Wallace brings his concerns regarding Dana to Simone, she is patronizing. Dana finds Wallace working in the lab Saturday morning. Page 92. Is there something I can do for you, Dana? I'm busy, he says as he turns back to his bench. He adjusts the plates next to his scope. He has lost his appetite for work. His hands are no longer steady. A tremor winds its way up and down his fingers. His knuckles ache. Come on, don't be that way, a cool laugh. Wallace stretches his fingers. The smell of gas, the low blue flame burns on. I'm not being away, Dana. I'm just busy. Perhaps you have heard of this thing called research. It requires work. Are these terms familiar to you? You sound like Brigitte. You two are such a weird little cult. Friendship, Dana. It too might be an unfamiliar concept for you. Admit it, she presses on. You two are just so clicky. You hardly talk to anyone else. You're like the only two people in lab and you talk so much shit about the rest of us. We're friends, Dana. We enjoy speaking to each other. I heard what you two were saying. I know what you two talk about when I'm not around, she said quickly. Wallace spins so they face each other again. He's surprised to find her looking down into the space between her thighs. Her scalp is red, dry. It's a curious position for her, as if someone set a stuffed animal on a shelf and left it. The blank vacancy of her body, he feels a flicker of sympathy, the memory of last night, of being discussed like an object of communal fascination. Even if we did talk about you, how would you know? He asks, and though the answer is obvious, gossip cuts both ways. Alliances shift. He's not the only one with allies. Dana doesn't rise to the bait. She's back to chewing on the ends of her fingers. Wallace's hands sting just watching. I don't think you ruined my plates, if that's what you're worried about, he says. A moment of silence. The flame hisses as it writhes in the air currents. It's a soft, fluttering sound, fire turning back on itself. So deep is the silence in that moment that he can hear the impurities in the stream of gas burning. But then a strange thing happens. An animatronic jerkiness shifts her shoulders, her arms, her legs, as if electricity was independently bringing parts of her to life. Low at first, a whisper, but then almost louder, laughter. Her head tosses back suddenly so hard and fast that he worries for a moment that she'll strike the shelf on Hendrik's bench. But she doesn't, just laughter. She grips her stomach, her thighs, her eyes filled with tears. Oh my God, listen to you. How arrogant can you be? Do you think I care what you think? Dana dries her tears. I cannot believe this. You actually think I care what you think? I don't understand, Wallace says, feeling more tired than he has in his entire life. I don't want to. Leave me alone. Yes, Wallace, I ruined your big experiment because I don't have enough things to do. That's me. I said I didn't think you did that, Dana. You don't have to be so ridiculous. I hate you, Wallace. And do you know why? Do you know why I hate you? Because you walk around like you're so important. Because you spent all your time working. You dump all your precious little time into this lab and into these dumb little experiments that don't matter. And you have the nerve to say to me, some of us work. Imagine you saying that to me, of all people. You aren't Katie, you're certainly not Brigitte, and yet you think you have the right to lecture me? Wallace can smell his own blood. He touches the end of his nose to see if there's blood there. But no, he isn't bleeding. There is just the metallic sheen of blood coating everything. Its beat, its bitterness. He can taste it too. Oh, no one could lecture you. Donna sits up straight. The laughter is gone, though the room rings with its ghost. You know what I think, Wallace? I think you're a misogynist. The word flicks by him. A shooting dot of silver. There's a momentary grit of bitter regret at the back of his throat. I'm not a misogynist. You don't get to define what misogyny is to a woman, asshole. You don't get to. Okay, he says. So, if I say you're a misogynist, you're a misogynist. Wallace turns from her. There's no arguing. This is why he keeps to himself. This is why he speaks to no one and does nothing. Fucking gay guys always think they've got the corner on oppression. I don't think that at all. And you think that you get to walk around because you're gay and black and act like you can do no wrong? No, I don't. You think you're the fucking queen of the world, she says, slapping her palms on the bench, which makes Wallace jump. Dana, I'm fed up with your shit. I'm fed up with you always talking down to me and treating me as if I'm beneath you. I'm tired of it. No one did that to you, Dana. No one has done anything to you except try to help you. But you won't be helped because you have to prove yourself. I have to prove myself because you and men like you are always counting me out. Well, fuck it. Women are the new niggers, the new faggots. A sour, wet taste spackles the roof of Wallace's mouth. The world is momentarily illuminated by something coarse and bright. He blinks. He grips the back of his chair to keep himself still, steady even. He thinks of Brigitte, her warmth, her kind voice. Dana pants like a winded, wounded animal. She has worked herself into a froth, into a violent anger. She's making fists over and over, her small hands turning to hard white knots. It isn't sympathy, he feels. They are beyond that now. But it is the first part of sympathy. Recognition. White foam sticks to the corners of her mouth. Her eyes flash and narrow. He recognizes himself in the futile, thrashing heat of her rage. The unfair thing is, he thinks, is that she is afforded this moment to vent herself. She'll be fine. She will be all right. She is gifted. And he is merely Wallace. None of this is fair. None of this is good, he knows. But he also knows that the point is not fairness. The point is not to be treated fairly or well. The point is to get your work done. The point is results. He can say something to her, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because no one is going to do his work for him. No one is going to say, well, Wallace, it's okay you didn't have your part of the data. You were being treated poorly. And there is the other thing, the shadow pain, he calls it, because he cannot say its real name, because to say its real name would be to cause trouble, to make waves, to draw attention to it as though it weren't in everything already. He tried once, with Simone, to talk about the way Katie talks to him as though he is inept. He said to Simone, she doesn't talk that way to anyone else. She doesn't treat them like this. And Simone said, Wallace, don't be dramatic. It isn't racism. You just need to catch up. Work harder. The most unfair part of it, Wallace thinks, is that when you tell white people that something is racist, they hold it up to the light and try to discern if you're telling the truth. as if they can tell by the grain of something if something is racist or not. They always trust their own judgment. It's unfair because white people have a vested interest in underestimating racism, its amount, its intensity, its shape, its effects. They are the fox in the hen house. Taylor's writing and Wallace pay a lot of attention to the human body. Wallace goes to play his weekly tennis game with Cole. As first-year students in the program, they had briefly flirted until Vincent came up to be with Cole. Roman and Klaus have been urging Vincent and Cole to be in an open relationship. Cole caught Vincent on a gay sex app, but he doesn't want Vincent to know that he's been checking up on him. Cole begs Wallace to come to the big dinner get-together that night for moral support. The dinner is a huge, awkward mess. Jung V is trying to set Miller up with a woman called Zoe. Enid and Nathan, the partners of Jung V and Lucas, are relegated to the side in the odd relationship between Jung V and Lucas. When Wallace tells the group he's thinking of dropping out of the program, Roman wonders, what other good prospects are there for a black man? He thinks Wallace is ungrateful for the benevolence the academic world has shown him. Roman thinks Wallace owes the department. They've spent money training him. A doctorate would give Wallace a person with deficiency and a challenging background, a better job, better prospects, better outlook. Without it, oh, you know, the stats are not good for black men. Wallace lashes out by asking Vincent why he was looking for sex on the gay app. Awkward, and it raises hell among the group. Wallace is stressed and wants to throw up, but in a funny moment, he just keeps shoveling the now tasteless food in his mouth. Wallace's mind is constantly busy with narratives of his own past and future. He consciously retreats into himself when his surroundings are unpleasant and upsetting. And this dinner is upsetting. Miller takes Wallace up to his room to sleep off the stress. He tells Wallace he nearly beat a youth to death since the guy had such a good life mapped out for himself and his mother had died of cancer and no one wanted Miller. Miller wants Wallace to reveal something about him. It's in these moments of sharing with Miller that we see revelations of some real self and another life, and God, what a life. We go back into Wallace's memories to his past. It's a hard past to read, and it's a hard past for Wallace to live with. He grows up in unimaginable poverty in rural Alabama in a trailer. A man his parents take in repeatedly molests Wallace. Wallace's mother blames him, calls him a faggot, but not son. His father is oddly proud that Wallace is molested or has allowed himself to be molested. It's a sickening situation where tenderness is in short supply. Wallace's father moves out down the lane but never contacts Wallace ever again. During summer, Wallace comes home to find his mother dead in her chair. Wallace lets a boy he likes use him for sex. Page 202. And when I let him push me down and punch me and kick me and break me, I kept praying, thinking that the pain I felt would absolve me, that the fire I felt in my guts would abate, would cleanse me. And overhead, trees dappled in sunlight. You can't know how beautiful the sun is there, how it touches everything and soaks it through, succulent like water, like moisture, light beading on the skin, dew glistening. So much light, an ocean of it, a sea of light spread across everything. He kicked and kicked and kicked, and I went home to wash it all off, the briars and the bruises and the places where he dented me, broken me, made me somehow uglier. And when I rubbed the salve on my skin, I kept thinking, kept hoping God would make me whole again. I wanted what I wanted, but I wanted not to what I wanted. I don't know much about God and the devil, except what you shouldn't do to invite one or the other, but I knew that I wanted to be full of one, and if that couldn't be the one I wanted, then I wanted to take the other. page 203. When I left it behind me, when I got up the money to go to school and get away, I sealed it all behind me. Because when you go to another place, you don't have to carry the past with you. You can lay it down. You can leave it for the ants. There comes a time when you have to stop being who you were, when you have to let the past stay where it is, frozen and impossible. You have to let it go if you're going to keep moving, if you're going to survive, because the past doesn't need a future. It has no use for what comes next. The past is greedy, always swallowing you up, always taking. If you don't hold it back, if you don't dam it up, it will spread and take and drown. The past is not a receding horizon. Rather, it advances one moment at a time, marching steadily forward until it has claimed everything, and we become again who we were. We become ghosts when the past catches us. I can't live as long as my past does. It's one or the other. The group meets for brunch on Sunday. Vincent makes it clear he hasn't forgotten or forgiven what Wallace did. He tells Wallace he intruded where he's not wanted. This is real life, and just because Wallace doesn't have anyone, he can't mess it up for others. Wallace just takes Vincent's abuse and says sorry. Back at the lab, Simone tells Wallace she doesn't think he has what it takes to be a scientist, that he doesn't want it as badly as the others in her lab, and that he should think about giving up. Wow. This guy has been in her program for 4 years already and is nearing the end, and now she tells him? Wallace meets Bridget for ice cream, and Bridget tells Wallace not to give up, but she also doesn't want him to be unhappy. It's his choice. Miller beats up a man who calls him a faggot in a bar and then comes to Wallace's apartment and starts to sexually assault him. After having sex, Miller takes Wallace to share the silence of the lake in the pre-dawn hours, and Wallace reciprocates by taking Miller to the rooftop of his apartment. Page 319. Behind them, the lake is full of luminous water. Miller bends over the edge of the building, its railing waist high, and he peers down into the world. Wallace sits on the ground next to him, knees against his chest. He usually comes here alone, to think and be by himself. He comes to feel the sense of the world around him, its forever shifting currents of air, their coldness on him, like a comforting hand. He comes to get away, but here he is with Miller. Miller crouches down next to Wallace, sits next to him. They sit that way for a long time, the stones sticking to their legs, at first painfully, and then numbly, like anything else. They watch the sun come up, its yellow light saturating everything and eventually burning away the mist of the morning. They're still sitting that way when the first sounds of cars fill the streets below and the world turns over itself to begin anew. Real life ends with what is actually the prologue to the book, a scene from 4 years ago when Wallace first arrives at the university full of hope and excitement to meet his new colleagues at the university. Wallace is not an easy protagonist to like. I cared about him, but I'm not sure I could wholly like him, and I'm not sure Wallace wholly likes himself either. Wallace feels invisible and devalued to his friends, his work, and sometimes he feels invisible to himself. When part of the group, Wallace very rarely engages in the conversation, preferring to watch and let his mind wander the halls of his past and his present. I don't know if the future is wondered very much here. Wallace is not blameless in some of his interactions. He struggles to recognize or have empathy for others in similar situations, such as Bridget, who has to live up to Simone's expectation of the perfect Asian student while assuming all Asians can be interchangeable, asking the Chinese-American Bridget for Japanese recipes. Crazy. The relationship with Miller was tender, violent, and disturbing. I don't know how long this relationship will last or if it has a future. I read the book over 2 days. It made me sad, but the gorgeous language moved me to keep reading. Towards the end of the book, though, I did feel helpless, frustrated, and a little angry with Wallace. I wanted him to push back more, to do something, to not be so passive. However, I was reminded that a couple of times that Wallace did push back against people and situations, it didn't go down very well. The dinner party comes to mind. Real life reminds me of books by Sally Rooney, and I really hope you get a chance to read Real Life. It will make you uncomfortable, definitely, and maybe re-examine your moral compass. Okay, so here are some book club questions for you to think about. Brandon Taylor's book is called Real Life. What does real life mean to you? Does everyone just have one real life, or can we have multiple real lives? How much does our past affect our future? Do you agree with Wallace that you cannot coexist with your past? Can people surviving traumatic incidences, do they need to jettison their past in order to survive? In Wallace's friend group, it becomes clear that the significant others of the main members don't like the friends. Do you get along with the friends of your partners? Is it important to get along? How does the utopian ideal of academia collide with the real life of Wallace? Dana tells Wallace he doesn't get to tell her what misogyny is. However, Simone tells Wallace that what he experiences is not racism. Can we discuss? What do you think Wallace decides to do? Does he stay on in the program or does he leave? If he leaves, what do you think Wallace will end up doing? I hope you get a chance to read Real Life. Bye-bye.